one sees every summer in Alaska and British Columbia. This is all very reassuring, of course, but suppose that Brett's original insight was right, and that what happened in North America at the end of the Ice Age really was a sudden cataclysmic flood, something unprecedented and unmatched since. Suppose it really was a debacle. Back to Brett's. Randall Carlson is quite certain that it was indeed a debacle, one that unfolded on an almost unbelievable scale, and has spent the last 20 years trekking back and forth across the channeled scablands, asking local geologists difficult questions that no one else seems to have considered, and building a formidable case. The sort of case, I suspect, that Brett's would be making if he were still with us and at the height of his powers. I first met Randall in 2006. The North American Ice Age floods were amongst the subjects we discussed, and I was startled to discover that he didn't accept the ice dam theory at all and regarded Glacial Lake Missoula as a huge diversion, an easy solution that panders to uniformitarian prejudices and has led geologists away from the truth. In the years that followed, we corresponded from time to time and occasionally bumped into each other at conferences where we were both speaking. I was enormously impressed by his depth of knowledge, by his field experience, and by the intriguing new insights his research seemed to offer into the mysterious events that brought the Ice Age to an end. I found we shared a particular and growing interest in the Younger Dryas, that return to full glacial conditions that began suddenly 12,800 years ago, just when the world seemed to be warming up, and that ended equally suddenly 1,200 years later. During this peculiar episode, certain Stone Age hunter-gatherer peoples such as the Clovis culture of North America vanished from the archaeological record, and there were mass extinctions of animal species, so clearly something unusual was going on. Yet no uniformitarian or gradualist explanations have ever been offered. Moreover, although I didn't investigate it in my 1995 book Fingerprints of the Gods, I realized afterwards that the span of the Younger Dryas from 12,800 years ago to 11,600 years ago coincided exactly with the window during which I had argued that an advanced civilization of prehistoric antiquity was obliterated from the face of the earth and lost from human memory. Accordingly, in my book Underworld, published in 2002, I was more attentive to the Younger Dryas problem. At around 13,000 years ago, I noted, the long period of uninterrupted warming that the world had just passed through, and that had greatly intensified according to some studies between 15,000 years ago and 13,000 years ago, was instantly brought to a halt, all at once, everywhere, by a global cold event known to paleoclimatologists as the Younger Dryas. In many ways mysterious and unexplained, this was an almost unbelievably fast climatic reversion, from conditions that are calculated to have been warmer and wetter than today's 13,000 years ago, to conditions that were colder and drier than those at the last glacial maximum just a few hundred years later. From that moment, around 12,800 years ago, it was as though an enchantment of ice had gripped the earth. In many areas that had been approaching terminal meltdown, full glacial conditions were restored with breathtaking rapidity, and all the gains that had been made since the LGM, last glacial maximum around 21,000 years ago, were simply stripped away. Temperatures fell back on the order of 8 to 15 degrees centigrade, with half this brutal decline possibly occurring within decades. The polar front in the North Atlantic redescended to the level of Cabo Finisterre in northwest Spain, and glaciers readvanced in the high mountain chains. With respect to temperature, the setback to full glacial conditions was nearly complete. For human populations at the time, in many except the most accidentally favored parts of the world, the sudden and inexplicable plunge into severe cold and aridity must have been devastating. The sense of mystery and mortal danger to mankind that clung about the Younger Dryas continued to intrigue me, encouraging me to read up on it and try to understand it better. I recall a number of conversations and email exchanges with Randall after 2006 that focused on the subject, and it became increasingly obvious to me that the Younger Dryas had been a global cataclysm in every meaningful sense of the term. It wasn't until 2013, however, when Randall made the case to me that North America, and particularly the Channeled Scablands, had stood at the epicenter of that cataclysm, that I decided it was time to see the evidence on the ground. On impulse, I invited him to join me on a field trip. It took more than a year to find a time that worked for both our schedules, but finally, in September 2014, I met Randall in Portland, Oregon, and we took off east and north into neighboring Washington state to explore the Scablands in the big red four-wheel drive we'd hired. Chapter 4. Journey Through the Scablands. We're on a 2,500-mile, 4,000-kilometer road trip from Portland, Oregon to Minneapolis, Minnesota. The journey would be shorter if we took the direct route, but we're stopping and diverting into coulees and river valleys and around buttes and up the sides of mountains and across the channeled scablands immediately south of the vast Cordilleran and Laurentide ice caps that once covered much of North America. The objective is for me to get as full an understanding as possible of what happened here, and by the fourth day, when we reach Dry Falls, in the middle of the extraordinary scar on the landscape called Grand Coulee, the picture is beginning to become clear. The ground under our feet is ancient black basalt, covered with a thin layer of topsoil. The basalt, extruded by volcanic eruptions between 17 million and 6 million years ago, covers much of the Columbia Plateau, and in some places is 2,000 meters, 6,600 feet thick. Not in Grand Coulee, though, because here it's as if some capricious force, perhaps even the hand of God himself, has seized a giant chisel with a blade miles wide, plunged it violently into the earth, and gouged out a sheer-sided gash hundreds of feet deep and almost 60 miles, 96 kilometers long. The chisel, however, was not made of steel, but of immense quantities of rushing, turbulent, debris-laden water that flowed for a few weeks only. The water of Bretz's flood. Grand Coulee, he wrote, affords the greatest example of canyon cutting by glacial streams, not alone for the Columbia Plateau, but for the world. A glacial river 3 miles in minimum width spilled southward here over the divide and down a steep monoclinal slope. The stream descended nearly 1,000 feet on a grade of approximately 10 degrees. Such a situation is unparalleled even in this region of huge, suddenly initiated high-gradient rivers. At least 10 cubic miles of basalt were excavated and removed. Bretz refers here only to the northern or upper part of Grand Coulee, but the same amount of basalt again was also excavated from lower Grand Coulee as the stream rushed on. Making our way here today, we paused in the Ephrata Erratix Fan, south of the southern end of Lower Grand Coulee, to see where all that basalt excavated by the waters was dumped. It was a chaotic, jumbled, disturbing sight. Disturbing because as far as the eye could see, in all directions across the prairie, lay scattered countless thousands, more likely millions, of jagged, broken basalt boulders, some about the size of a family car, some smaller, down to the size of a football, and many larger. Everything was reduced to rubble, Randall Carson explained to me as we stood there in the midst of the fan, and that's what you're seeing. This rubble was part of the former world. The former world? Yes, the antediluvian world, and what's lying here on the surface is just a fraction of what the flood flushed out of Grand Coulee. The rubble goes down deep, hundreds of feet deep. From the Ephrata Fan, we drove north on Washington State Route 17 into Lower Grand Coulee, its sheer, forbidding basalt cliffs rearing up on either side of us. The grey rain clouds above reflected darkly in the chain of alkaline lakes, Soap Lake, Lenore Lake, Blue Lake, and Park Lake, that lie ponded in its floor. Now we've reached Dry Falls at the head of Lower Grand Coulee, and as we get out of the truck, Randall reminds my wife Santha to bring her camera. You're going to see something cataclysmic here, he announces, with a mischievous grin. Meet Randall Carson. You may be too young to remember the 1977 TV series called The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams, but you can always Google it if you weren't here. The eponymous hero, a tough woodsman played by actor Dan Haggerty, was a big, bluff, bearded sort of fellow. and Randall Carlson, by virtue of his enormous beard, his general appearance, and his rough, gruff personal style, reminds me of him a lot. Randall lives in Atlanta, Georgia now, but he spent most of his youth in rural Minnesota, and his voice still carries the quirky undertones of Scandinavian and German that make the Minnesota accent so recognizable. He grew up on the shores of Schmidt Lake, one of tens of thousands of small meltwater lakes spread across Minnesota and Wisconsin, and he used to go fishing there as a boy, perched on a huge boulder that he afterwards understood to be a glacial erratic, a boulder quarried from bedrock and carried by an advancing glacier, perhaps many hundreds of miles from its source, to be deposited in a location far removed from its origin. Today, half a century on from his boyhood, he says that the Midwestern landscapes of his youth have left an indelible imprint on his psyche. From these early experiences, I entered into a sort of dialogue with the earth, which continues unabated to this day. This dialogue has involved thousands of hours spent in the field, traversing and studying a wide variety of landscapes, along with thousands of hours in the study of various sciences related in one way or another to the goal of understanding this extraordinary planet upon which we are engaged in this ongoing human experience. It is a fearsomely dynamic planet, one that has undergone profound changes on a scale far exceeding anything within recent times. In fact, I now realize that what we think of as history is merely the record of human events that have transpired since the last great planetary catastrophe. I also understand that the imprint of these catastrophes is to be found all around us, in virtually every environment, and we are just beginning to be able to perceive and decipher the evidence. Randall makes his living as an architect and builder, but his passion is geology. Catastrophist geology. And as those of us who have attended one of his lectures will attest, he knows more about it than pretty much anyone else you are ever likely to meet. He has gleaned his knowledge from a vast reading of the scientific literature, and, as he says above, from thousands of hours of fieldwork. To me, this sort of in-depth, on-the-ground learning, the miles walked through the wilderness, the years of dedicated library research, mean far more than any university degree. Randall is not a geologist and does not claim to be a geologist, but his grasp of the subject is worth a dozen PhDs. And right now, we're standing on a sort of concrete pier with waist-high fencing, suspended out over the plunging horseshoe amphitheater of dry falls. There's a chill wind blowing this late September day, and Randall is about to give me a geology lesson. Dry falls. Ever been to Niagara Falls? Randall asks. I confess that I have not. But you've seen photographs? You have a sense of the place? I suppose so, yes. Okay, so just a guess. Which is bigger? He indicates the vista that confronts us. Dry Falls or Niagara? I'm thinking it's a trick question. Randall, being a Minnesotan, is of course compelled to ask trick questions. I look out at the natural amphitheater. It's a long way down, and a long way across. A couple of circular lakes of pooled rainwater, overgrown with reeds, decorate the base of the towering horseshoe of sheer cliffs confronting me, over which, it is absolutely obvious, huge quantities of water must once have flowed. I haven't been to the Niagara Falls, which are 51 meters high, but I did spend a day of amazement at Victoria Falls in southern Africa, and they're 108 meters high. The classic horseshoe shape of Niagara that you see in all the pictures is repeated at Victoria Falls, and here's the same horseshoe shape in Washington State in the U.S., preserved in the dry fossil of an ancient cataract. Dry Falls is bigger than Niagara, I say, sounding more confident than I feel. Okay, good so far, but how much bigger? Twice as big, I hazard a guess. Not bad, Randall says, but actually Dry Falls is close to three times as high as Niagara and more than six times as wide. He points, see how the cliffs are scalloped there? I do. The Dry Falls horseshoe is in fact two horseshoes side by side, one to the east, one to the west. Well, Niagara would easily fit into just half of the eastern horseshoe, and its rim would be almost 250 feet beneath the rim of Dry Falls. Also, look there. Randall draws my attention to the eastern side of the horseshoe, where there's a gap and then a high, narrow fin of cliffs running south. That's Umatilla Rock, he says, indicating the fin. It would have been a kind of island at the peak of the flood, an underwater island.
Underwater?
Yes. When the flood came through here, the water was more than 500 feet deep. It would have overtopped Umatilla Rock and the falls themselves, and right here where we're standing by, 100, maybe 150 feet. So if I'd been able to stand here then, which you wouldn't have, I know, I'd have been swept away, but just for the sake of argument, if I'd been able to stand here, I take it I wouldn't have seen a sheer sheet of water bursting over the lip of the falls and crashing down hundreds of feet. No, because that was happening far beneath the surface. What you would have seen at this point would have looked more like a whirling, churning slope in the torrent, with some kind of abrupt bump or gradient in it than an actual waterfall. But all the work that a waterfall does on rock was still going on under the surface. What do you mean by work on the rock? The water is coming through here in enormous quantities and horribly fast, running at up to 70 miles an hour, according to some estimates. And you've got to realize that it isn't just water. It's more like a slurry of thick mud, and there's whole forests torn up by their roots that are roiling around in it, and fleets of icebergs jostling on the surface, and down at the bottom there's a huge rumbling rubble of rocky debris, boulders like the ones we saw dumped all over the Ephrata Fan, and this whole mess is rushing and tumbling and plucking as it passes.
Plucking?
Yes, that's the best way to describe it, like giant fingers plucking out blocks of the basalt bedrock, ripping them out, dragging them into the torrent and sweeping them downstream. That's how the erosive work is done. Randall gestures again at the scalloped horseshoe cliffs. But what we see from here is less than half the picture. If we were up in an airplane looking down, we'd see another set of horseshoes, even bigger than these ones off to the east, wrapping round beyond Umatilla Rock. So with all that taken into account, what's the total extent of dry falls? About 3.5 miles. That was where it had got to when the flood stopped. God only knows what it would have ended up looking like or where it would have been today if the flood had continued even for another couple of weeks. I don't understand. The indications are that the flood only lasted a matter of weeks, and throughout that time the falls were constantly migrating northwards.
Migrating?
Yes. All falls migrate, at different rates depending on the amount and force of the water flowing over them. They pluck at the bedrock and constantly eat it away upstream. Take Niagara, for example. It's retreated 7 miles in the last 12,000 years, but that's puny compared with what happened here, where the retreat was about 30 miles, the whole length of Lower Grand Coulee, in less than a month. So the rate of erosion was incredibly fast.
Yes.
Thousands of times faster than Niagara, because of the incredible amount and force of the water here. Dry Falls was the greatest waterfall that's ever existed on planet Earth.
And all that water's supposed to have come out of Glacial Lake Missoula?
Well, says Randall, his beard juts out stubbornly, that's the theory. Erratic hunting. Randall doesn't buy the gradualist theory that multiple emptyings of Lake Missoula through multiple breakings and remakings and breaking again of its ice dam can account for the evidence on the ground. He doesn't dispute that the glacial lake existed or that there were outburst floods from it, but he's convinced it was never anywhere near big enough to account for all the cataclysmic features of the channeled scablands. Like J. Harlan Brett's in the 1920s, he believes that one sudden, short-lived, totally exceptional flood of truly immense proportions was the real culprit. On another day, Randall takes me erratic hunting to explain why. We pull off Interstate 97 onto the Waterville Plateau and drive across rugged, rolling country where occasional green and yellow fields intermingle with wilder moorland, too poor ever to be farmed. Pretty soon we start seeing huge clusters, flocks, packs, crowds of giant boulders, all of ominous black basalt, all alien to this landscape, and I know enough now to recognize them for what they are. As ice caps move and spread, they snatch up, enchain, and transport huge rocks that then remain locked within them until the ice melts and drops its load. What happened here? The place is actually called Boulder Park and is recognized as a national natural landmark,
was a different aspect of the same process. When the Ice Age flood came pouring down over the Waterville Plateau, Randall explains, it was carrying thousands of icebergs with it, icebergs as big as oil tankers with house-sized boulders frozen inside them. When they bumped up against hillsides, he points to a distant ridge with ranks of colossal boulders strewn across it. The icebergs grounded and stuck there. Eventually, after the flood had subsided, they melted out, leaving the boulders where they sit to this day, strewn all over the top of the plateau beyond the ridge and carpeting the hillside for 20 miles going north. But that ridge must be, what, 800, maybe 900 feet above us, I observe? Exactly, which tells us that the water was at least that deep here, or rather not simply water, but a sludge slurry, and as the flood starts to subside, the slurry just gets thicker and thicker with sediment until it finally leaves the whole valley floor covered in sediment, hundreds of feet thick, and filled with embedded boulders. I mean, again, we're looking at the ruins and wreckage of a former world. We get back onto Interstate 97, heading south along the west bank of the majestic Columbia River, and divert west on alternate 97 towards Lake Chelan. 50 miles long and never more than a mile and a half wide, lying in the bottom of a forested, steep-sided valley overshadowed by lofty mountains, Chelan has the look and feel of a grand Scottish loch. It's appropriate, therefore, that it also has traditions of a lake monster, a dragon, according to Native American legends, that ate up all the game, leaving the people starving. The Great Spirit was angered and decided to intervene. He descended from the sky and struck the earth with his huge stone knife. All the world shook from his blow. A great cloud appeared over the plain. When the cloud went away, people saw that the land had changed. Huge mountain peaks rose on all sides of them. Among the mountains were canyons. Extending from the northwest to the southeast for a 2 days' journey was a very deep canyon. The Great Spirit threw the monster's body into this deep and long gorge. Then he poured much water into it and so formed the lake. Long afterwards, Indians called it Chelan. Chelan means deep water in the local Salish Indian language, and Lake Chelan is indeed 1,468 feet, 453 meters deep, making it the third deepest lake in the US and the 26th deepest in the world. Some aspects of the myth, I note in passing, are evocative of earth changes at the end of the Ice Age. Mountains that had been hidden beneath the ice cap, and that therefore no one had seen before, did indeed appear when the ice melted. Canyons were indeed carved through the whole of the Columbia Plateau by the rushing waters of Bretz's flood. And as we will see in the next chapter, there may also be more than meets the eye to the huge stone knife from the sky, striking the ground so hard that the world shook, and to that ominous cloud that appeared over the land. Likewise, the presence of an immense iceberg-rafted erratic above the town of Manson on Chelan's north shore suggests that the notion of much water being poured into the lake, in other words, of a flood passing through here, may also be rooted in memories of real events. After passing more erratics scattered around the southern end of Lake Chelan, we head back to Interstate 97, cross to the east bank of the Columbia River at Beeb Bridge, then go north to the mouth of McNeil Canyon, where yet more boulder-strewn moorland awaits us. Numbering in their thousands, the erratics here are known locally as haystack boulders because of their distinctive appearance. But the rounded profile they show from a distance gives way close up to a mass of jagged and splintered basalt. Many of them are thought to weigh more than 10,000 tons, and as Randall and I examine them, I'm daunted by their great height and mass and amazed at the power and energy of the floodwaters that brought them here. We get back on Interstate 97 again and drive the 40 miles south to the confluence of the Wenatchee and Columbia Rivers near the eastern foothills of the Cascade Mountains. Here Randall has a last giant erratic to show me, this one weighing, he estimates, 18,000 tons. It stands high up on the side of a long, wide valley, looming over a modern housing development, hundreds of feet above the confluence of the rivers and the town of Wenatchee. We scramble to the top of the erratic, so we can look down on the rivers glistening far below. Obviously, Randall explains, the flood waters must have filled the whole valley from bottom to top, So when the iceberg floated in, it stranded right here, then melted away and left this sitting on the ridge. And the flood itself? Where did it go next? The water coming down through here met the water coming out of Grand Coulee and Moses Coulee and many other Scabland channels, and then it all together flowed down to Pasco Basin and Wallula Gap. Black rain. The next day finds us on top of a high bluff overlooking Wallula Gap. So the water here rose up to roughly 1,200 feet above sea level, Randall says. He consults his GPS. And where we're standing now is 1,150 feet above sea level, so the flood would have been 50 feet over our heads. And the water came from which direction? Randall points north. It came roaring out of the channeled scablands. A mass of different flows converged here, and then passed on through down the Columbia. So this was the gathering of the waters. Here's where all these great flood streams came together. I look out over the scene below. A drama of earth and sky and water. The sky is grey, thunderous and filled with rain as it has been throughout our trip. The earth element begins with a very thick, powdery layer of soft, dun-coloured dust called loess that lies everywhere under our feet on the top of the bluff. But then the bluff plunges away in a steep, tumbling fall down to the Columbia, which forms the water element below. Across the stream, more than a mile wide here, the terrain rises again towards the east, not so sheer as on the west side where we're standing, still covered by that same thick layer of powdery loess, and marked in addition by distinctive scabland topography, with cliffs plunging into valleys, and a series of outcrops carved by the ancient floods, most prominently the two isolated basalt pillars known as the Twin Sisters that stand directly opposite us. Those Twin Sisters, Randall explains, are a remnant. Look there, immediately to the left of the sisters you can see a shelf. That would have all been continuous. I believe that was the pre-flood valley floor. When the flood hit, it ripped through here and lowered the valley floor by about 200 feet, based on the present depth of the river and the height of the Twin Sisters. Had the flood continued for a week longer, the twins would have been washed away as well. They would have been about 800 feet underwater. And really, if you look across there, way above the level of the sisters, you'll see that uppermost crop of basalt, roughly at our level. That would have been the high water mark, and everything below that was underwater at the peak of the flood. So what you're seeing over there in the scabland around the sisters is that spectacular erosion of the basalt by the water just ripping through here at 60 or 70 miles an hour, because the back pressure would have been so great. Fearsome and ferocious flows, I hazard. Oh my God, yes, Randall replies, like an inland sea, except that it's moving. And it's turbulent and it's angry. Yes, says Randall, and the turbulence is increasing massively as it comes up to this constriction at Wallula Gap. But when you look at the capacity of this valley, it would have had to have been a hell of a lot of water pouring in from the north to backflood to the extent that it did. The valley out of Lake Missoula is no bigger than this one, and it's 200 miles north of here. So how could that water have spilled out of Lake Missoula, travelled 200 miles to here, and not have attenuated to the degree that it would just pass through without ponding above the gap? But it did pond, massively and deeply, as we can tell from the high water mark, and that, to me, is just incontrovertible evidence that there was more water pouring into this than could ever have been pouring out of Lake Missoula. So, I summarize, we have water 1,200 feet deep which flows through here turbulently. Very turbulently, Randall agrees. And then how long does it stay that deep? The estimates are that it's probably 1 to 3 weeks, offers Randall. And then it begins to ebb away, because they call this hydraulic ponding. This was effectively a hydraulic dam in the sense that the water itself, forced through a constriction like Wallula Gap, becomes a kind of dam, and especially so since the water here was filled with massive icebergs. All throughout the flood pathway are erratics that were carried by icebergs, all the way down into Eugene, Oregon. You've got to picture it. You've got a moving sea, choked with thousands of icebergs. I'm getting the picture all right. Wild scene, I say. Wild scene, Randall agrees. All of these icebergs are jostling up against each other and getting jammed in the gap. and what that's going to do is cause the water level to rise still further until the pressure increases enough to push the whole mass down through the gap. Then the water level drops until the next jam occurs. So I think what we're seeing is a pulsating hydrograph, that every time it rises, it backfloods further up the valley, and then the water level drops and then it rises again. The next point I put to Randall, closely connected to the vision of the flooded hell world that he's just conjured up, relates to the central enigma I wish to explore in the rest of this section, but which I have not yet placed before the reader. It concerns the growing body of evidence that 12,800 years ago, a giant comet, traveling on an orbit that took it through the inner solar system, broke up into multiple fragments, and that many of these fragments, some more than a mile, 2.4 kilometers in diameter, hit the Earth. It is believed that North America was the epicenter of the resulting cataclysm, with several of the largest impacts on the North American ice cap causing floods and tidal waves and throwing a vast cloud of dust into the upper atmosphere that enshrouded the Earth, preventing the sun's rays from reaching the surface, and thus initiating the sudden, mysterious global deep freeze that geologists call the Younger Dryas. We'll go into the evidence for all this and how it relates to Bretz's flood, which might not, after all, have emerged from Lake Missoula, in the chapters that follow. But for now, please bear with me as I play out the rest of my conversation with Randall at Wallula Gap. And there's been a comet impact, I say, so we're expecting that the sky is going to be bad too. Oh, it's got to be, Randall replies. Dark, I think about it, then add. Lots of stuff wafted up there by the impact. Stuff. Randall kicks a furrow in the soft dust with the toe of his hiking boot. That's what I think this 6-foot layer of Lois is. All over the flood areas you see this 6, 7, 8 foot thick layer of Lois, and clearly it rained down out of the atmosphere. Like the legends of Kon-Tiki Viracocha, I name the South American civilizing hero, white-skinned and bearded like Quetzalcoatl and the Apkalu sages described in Chapter 1, who was said to have come to the Andes during a terrifying period, thousands of years in the past, when the earth had been inundated by a great flood and plunged into darkness by the disappearance of the sun. Exactly like Quetzalcoatl in Mexico and the Apkalu sages in Mesopotamia, Viracocha's civilizing mission in the Andes had been to bring laws and a moral code to the survivors of the disaster, and to teach them the skills of agriculture, architecture, and engineering. Ah yes, Randall muses, the legends of Viracocha. Wasn't there something about a black rain? There was, absolutely, a thick black rain. It's pretty much universal to the flood myths I've studied. Randall kicks the Lois again. This stuff is puzzling, you know. It has a kind of vertical structure. Most theories suggest that it's windborne, but the vertical structure is inconsistent with that. I'm developing an idea that it's actually both water and windborne, because I think that the final rainout after the comet hit the ice cap was essentially a rainout of mud. There would have been a huge injection of superheated water into the stratosphere, filthy, particle-laden water, which would have then spread rather like the debris cloud of a nuclear explosion, and the end result would undoubtedly have been a very intense and prolonged rainout. But did a comet hit the Earth 12,800 years ago? As we'll see in the next chapter, the evidence assembled by an international team of highly credentialed scientists is taking the comfortable world of gradualist, uniformitarian geology by storm. Chapter 5. Nanodiamonds Are Forever. Continuing our journey east through the northern states of the U.S. after leaving Washington and driving across the Idaho Panhandle, Randall made a point of showing me some of the spectacular features of Camas Prairie in western Montana. There, what looked to the unpracticed eye like a series of colossal dunes march in serried ranks across the flat yellow floor of an elliptical basin 12 miles long and 10 miles wide in the midst of the Rocky Mountains. But the dunes, it turns out, are not dunes at all. Instead, they're giant current ripples, some more than 50 feet high and 300 feet long, formed at the end of the Ice Age when Camas Prairie was part of the bed of Glacial Lake Missoula and lay under about 1,400 feet of water. Geologists are agreed that the ripples were shaped by powerful currents set in motion when the lake drained catastrophically. And I don't dispute it, Randall says, as we stand on a vantage point above the prairie. A largely deserted highway runs through the floor of the ancient basin, but now as a vehicle appears, providing scale, I see that it's dwarfed to matchbox size by the ripples. So, I ask, you have nothing against the existence of Lake Missoula as such, or the notion that it did drain catastrophically? No, nothing at all, Randall replies. I have no doubt there were dozens of joculaps out of Lake Missoula. Some were even pretty big. My point, though, is that none of them were of sufficient size to cause the spectacular flood damage that we've seen in the Channeled Scablands. That was done by an event orders of magnitude bigger than anything Lake Missoula could provide. So, yes, the lake was dammed by ice in the Clark Fork Valley, just as the gradualists maintain. And yes, that ice dam did break frequently over a period of a few thousand years, say from 15,000 years ago down to about 13,000 years ago. But the amount of water released in these periodic floods was minuscule, just a drop in the bucket compared to the final event in which Lake Missoula was also involved, of course, but definitely not as the main culprit. And that final event had to do with the impact of our comet? I've started calling it ours, but it's usually referred to in the scientific literature as the Clovis Comet, or the Younger Dryas Comet. You bet, Randall replies. But not just one impact, multiple impacts. I'm guessing as many as four of the fragments, each of them maybe half a mile across, maybe bigger, hit the Cordilleran and Laurentide ice caps in a sort of scattergun effect, and caused just a massive amount of instantaneous melting. The meltwater was everywhere, in enormous quantities. Naturally, some of it cascaded into Lake Missoula, filling it up suddenly and causing it to burst its ice dam, thus adding its contents to the much bigger floods that were already sweeping down from the north. So Lake Missoula was more of an innocent bystander, really, than the culprit. Randall chuckles. Yes, that's right. The lake was the innocent bystander that was in the way and that later got accused of the crime. But the comet was the culprit. Conspiracy Corner. I'm no conspiracy theorist, but I have a sneaking feeling, nothing more, that something a bit like a conspiracy is at work in science to prevent the proper consideration and wide public uptake of catastrophist ideas. I gave the example of J. Harlan Bretz in Chapter 3. The frosty and deeply unpleasant reception initially given to his findings, the years that he spent in academic limbo afterwards, the repeated, persistent efforts made by a host of scholars to dismiss his evidence entirely, or failing that, to account for it by gradualist means. And then at last, years later, when all that had failed and the notion of outburst floods from glacial Lake Missoula had offered itself as a solution, the realization that he had been right all along. But not right. Not right under any circumstances. Not right in any imaginable universe on the issue of the single cataclysmic debacle that his instincts had originally led him to. If J. Harlan Bretz was to be right, then it was necessary that he should be right in a politically correct way. In other words, in a way that could be redacted by skilled uniformitarian spinmeisters to edit out any hint of lurking cosmic disaster. Indeed, within the fantasy of such a conspiracy, I sincerely hope it is a fantasy, the joculaps idea is an exceptionally useful one. First of all, it provides what purports to be a wholesomely rational, sober, and above all, scientific account of the tortured geological features witnessed by Bretz in the Scablands. Secondly, joculaps happen every year in various parts of the world today, and thus do not violate the commandment that existing processes, acting as at present, must be held sufficient to account for all geological changes. Thirdly, present relevance can be assigned. The Ice Age floods need not be simply of scholarly interest. Since joculaps still occur in the 21st century, science can be brought to bear to anticipate and ameliorate their effects. All of this might start to look like a very effective diversion from the truth, if the truth is that a cataclysm, a single, prodigious cataclysm, did occur at the end of the Ice Age, and might, furthermore, recur. What, in other words, if the Ojibwa prophecy is true? What if the star with the long, white tail is indeed going to destroy the world someday, when it comes low again. Would those who know this benefit from sharing their knowledge with others? Or might they think it served their interests better to keep quiet about the whole thing? We'll return to this in chapter 19. By comparison, the question we have to ask and answer first is much simpler. Was the Younger Dryas cold event that began so suddenly and so mysteriously 12,800 years ago brought on by the effects of a large comet hitting the Earth? The evidence for the comet. The Younger Dryas, YD, impact hypothesis, as its proponents restated it in a keynote paper in the Journal of Geology in September 2014, proposes that a major cosmic impact event occurred at the Younger Dryas boundary, YDB, 12,800 years ago. The paper, as we will see, presented a mass of new evidence in support of the hypothesis, in particular confirming and greatly extending earlier evidence of the copious presence of nanodiamonds in samples from the Younger Dryas boundary layer taken in many different countries. Nanodiamonds are microscopic diamonds that form under rare conditions of great shock, pressure, and heat, and are recognized as being amongst the characteristic fingerprints, proxies in scientific language, of powerful impacts by comets or asteroids. By 2014, when the Journal of Geology paper was published, debate over whether or not a comet impact was involved in setting off the Younger Dryas had been raging for 7 years. The first headline that caught my eye was in New Scientist magazine of the 22nd of May 2007 and asked provocatively, "Did a comet wipe out prehistoric Americans?" At that time, 2007, I was taking a break from the lost civilization mystery that had absorbed my energies and been the subject of so many of my books for so long. The New Scientist article tweaked my curiosity, however, because it referred to the exact epoch that I had focused on in my books. The article didn't speak of a lost civilization, but began with a reference to the so-called Clovis culture of North America, which, as we saw in Chapter 3, vanished from the archaeological record during the Younger Dryas between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. The Clovis people, the article observed, flourishing some 13,000 years ago, had a mastery of stone weaponry that stood them in good stead against the constant threat of large carnivores such as American lions and giant short-faced bears. It's unlikely, however, that they thought death would come from the sky. According to results presented by a team of 25 researchers this week at the American Geophysical Union meeting in Acapulco, Mexico, that's where the Clovis people's doom came from. Citing several lines of evidence, the team suggests that a wayward comet hurtled into the Earth's atmosphere around 12,900 years ago. Note, that date would later be revised downwards by 100 years to 12,800 years ago. Fractured into pieces and exploded in giant fireballs. Debris seems to have settled as far afield as Europe. As I read on, I learnt that the team the article was referring to was composed of highly credentialed and eminently respectable mainstream scientists. Jim Kennett, an oceanographer at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and one of the team's three principal investigators, claims immense wildfires scorched North America in the aftermath, killing large populations of mammals and bringing an abrupt end to the Clovis culture. The entire continent was on fire, he says. Lead team member Richard Firestone, a nuclear analytical chemist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California, says the evidence lies in a narrow, 12,900-year-old carbon-rich layer of sediment found at 8 well-dated Clovis-era sites and a peppering of sediment cores across North America as well as one site in Belgium. Probed as to why no crater had yet been identified with this hypothetical impact 12,900 years ago, a third team member, Arizona-based geophysicist Alan West, suggested that smaller, low-density parts of the comet would have exploded in the atmosphere, while larger fragments might have crashed into the 2-mile-deep ice cap that covered North America at that time. Such craters, West observed, would have been ice-walled and basically melted away at the end of the last ice age, leaving few traces. The article went on to explain that the sediment samples the team's evidence focused on contained several different types of debris that could only have come from an extraterrestrial source such as a comet or an asteroid. As well as nanodiamonds, the debris included tiny carbon spherules that form when molten droplets cool rapidly in air, and carbon molecules containing the rare isotope helium-3, far more abundant in the cosmos than on Earth. You might find some other explanation for these individually, says Firestone, but taken together, it's pretty clear that there was an impact. The team says the agent of destruction was probably a comet, since the key sediment layer lacks both the high nickel and iridium levels characteristic of asteroid impacts. Last but not least, the New Scientist article confirmed, all the evidence pointed to North America as the epicenter of the disaster. Levels of the apparent extraterrestrial debris, for example, are highest at the Gainey archaeological site in Michigan, just beyond the southern reach of North America's primary ice sheet 12,900 years ago. Moreover, levels decrease the further you go from Gainey, suggesting that the comet blew up largely over Canada. In other words, largely over the ice cap that covered the northern half of North America during the Ice Age, the source of all the meltwater that scarred and hacked the scablands of Washington State in Bretz's flood. Whether or not that meltwater came exclusively from Lake Missoula or gushed forth in far larger quantities than Lake Missoula alone could ever have held. Bretz himself, as we've seen, was forced to abandon his own strong intuition that there had been a single massive meltwater flood in favor of multiple flushings of limited amounts of meltwater out of Lake Missoula again and again over thousands of years. The primary reason he embraced this theory, however, was not that he had become a convert to gradualism, but because he was never able to explain how a large enough area of the ice cap to supply all the vast amounts of water needed for his flood could simply have melted all at once. He had proposed two possibilities: dramatic overnight global warming on the one hand, or volcanic activity under the ice cap on the other. But as the reader will recall, he very quickly conceded there was no evidence for either. What Bretz did not consider, and could not consider, because the supporting evidence only began to come in a quarter of a century after his death, was the possibility that the ice cap could have undergone cataclysmic melting as a result of a comet impact. If only Bretz had known. A few months after the article appeared in New Scientist, the Clovis Comet team published a detailed paper on their findings. It appeared in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS, on the 9th of October 2007. Despite the sober setting, the headline was dramatic. Evidence for an extraterrestrial impact 12,900 years ago that contributed to the megafaunal extinctions and the Younger Dryas cooling. A carbon-rich layer, summarized the team, dating to around 12,900 years ago, has previously been identified at Clovis Age sites across North America and appears contemporaneous with the abrupt onset of the Younger Dryas YD cooling. The in-situ bones of extinct Pleistocene megafauna, along with Clovis tool assemblages, occur below this black layer, but not within or above it. Causes for the extinctions, YD cooling, and termination of Clovis culture have long been controversial. In this paper, we provide evidence for an extraterrestrial, ET, impact event close to 12,900 years ago, which we hypothesized caused abrupt environmental changes that contributed to YD cooling, major ecological reorganization, broad-scale extinctions, and rapid human behavioral shifts at the end of the Clovis period. Clovis Age sites in North America are overlain by a thin, discrete layer with varying peak abundances of 1. Magnetic grains with iridium, 2. Magnetic microspherules, 3. Charcoal, 4. Soot, 5. Carbon spherules, 6. Glass-like carbon containing nanodiamonds, and 7. Fullerenes with ET helium, all of which are evidence for an ET impact and associated biomass burning circa 12,900 years ago. We propose that one or more large, low-density ET objects exploded over northern North America, partially destabilizing the Laurentide ice sheet and triggering YD cooling. The shockwave, thermal pulse, and event-related environmental effects, e.g. extensive biomass burning and food limitations, contributed to megafaunal extinctions. Nor were the mammoths, mastodons, ground sloths, horses, camels, giant beaver, and other megafauna alone. In total, it is particularly striking that no less than 35 genera of mammals, with each genus consisting of several species, became extinct in North America between 12,900 and 11,600 years ago. In other words, precisely during the mysterious Younger Dryas cold event. What was now emerging, therefore, was an explanation both for the sudden onset of the Younger Dryas itself and for the accompanying extinctions, and perhaps for much else besides, including the cataclysmic flooding that left its marks on the channeled scablands of Washington State. This seemed all the more plausible when I learned that Firestone Kennett and West's proposal for their comet was that it was a conglomeration of impactors, including one that might have been as much as 4 kilometers, 2.5 miles in diameter. Furthermore, that 4-kilometer object would itself have been just one amongst multiple fragments, resulting from the earlier disintegration, while still in orbit, of a giant comet up to 100 kilometers or more in diameter. Many of the fragments of the parent comet, including some of great size as we'll see in Chapter 19, remained in orbit. Those that hit the Earth at the onset of the Younger Dryas underwent further explosive fragmentation, accompanied by powerful airbursts that would themselves have had cataclysmic effects as they entered the atmosphere over Canada. Nonetheless, the authors thought it likely that a number of large impactors up to 2 kilometers in diameter would have remained intact to collide with the ice cap. There, as West had earlier told New Scientist, any craters would have been transient, leaving few permanent traces on the ground after the ice had melted. Lasting evidence, the PNAS paper added, may have been limited to enigmatic depressions or disturbances in the Canadian Shield, for example under the Great Lakes or Hudson Bay. Summarizing the damage, the authors envisaged a devastating high-temperature shockwave with extreme overpressure followed by underpressure, resulting in intense winds traveling across North America at hundreds of kilometers an hour, accompanied by powerful impact-generated vortices. In addition, whether single or multiple objects collided with the Earth, a hot fireball would have immersed the region near the impacts. At greater distances, the re-entry of high-speed superheated ejecta would have induced extreme wildfires, which would have decimated forests and grasslands, destroying the food supplies of herbivores and producing charcoal, soot, toxic fumes, and ash. And how might all this have caused the dramatic cooling of the Younger Dryas? The authors offered many mechanisms operating together. Amongst the most prominent of these being the huge plume of water vapor from the melted ice cap that would have been cast into the upper atmosphere, combined with immense quantities of dust and debris composed of the impactor, ice sheet detritus, and the underlying crust, as well as the smoke and soot from continent-wide wildfires. Taken in sum, it's quite easy to understand how so much lofted debris could, as the authors propose, have led to cooling by blockage of sunlight. Meanwhile, the water vapor, smoke, soot, and ice would have promoted the growth of persistent cloudiness and noctilucent clouds, leading to reduced sunlight and surface cooling, thus reducing the solar insulation at high latitudes, increasing snow accumulation, and causing further cooling in the feedback loop. Severe and devastating enough in themselves, these factors nonetheless pale into insignificance when compared with the consequences of the hypothesized impacts on the ice cap. The largest potential effect would have been impact-related partial destabilization and/or melting of the ice sheet. In the short term, this would have suddenly released meltwater and rafts of ice into the North Atlantic and Arctic oceans, lowering ocean salinity with consequent surface cooling. The longer-term cooling effects would have resulted largely from the consequent weakening of thermohaline circulation in the northern Atlantic, sustaining YD cooling for more than 1,000 years, until the feedback mechanisms restored ocean circulation. Impact-related partial destabilization and/or melting of the ice sheet, and on a scale capable of disrupting the circulation of the world's oceans for more than 1,000 years, this matter of thermohaline circulation is an important one that requires explanation. We'll return to it, But what most struck me in the paragraph quoted above was that the authors had only considered the consequences of the huge quantities of icebergs and meltwater dumped into the oceans north and east of the epicenter of their proposed comet impacts. They did not consider the effects of that gigantic icy flood on the lands lying immediately south of the ice cap, which most certainly would not have been spared. Once again, I found myself wondering how J. Harlan Bretz might have reacted if information about a possible comet impact had been at his disposal during his lifetime. I can't prove it, of course, but I think he would have been much less likely to be seduced by Lake Missoula gradualism, and much more likely, now that a credible heat source had been provided, to stick to his catastrophist guns. A single cataclysmic meltwater flood on a truly gigantic scale, coming directly off the ice cap to scour the scablands, begins to look very feasible indeed in the light of the case made by Firestone West, Kennett, and the large team of scientists working with them. Meanwhile, my own hypothesis of an advanced civilization of prehistoric antiquity obliterated from the face of the earth during the Younger Dryas window is also strengthened by their work. For if their calculations are correct, the explosive power of the Younger Dryas comet would have been of the order of 10 million megatons. That makes it 2 million times greater in its effects than the former USSR's Tsar Bomba, the largest nuclear weapon ever tested, and 1,000 times greater than the estimated explosive power, 10,000 megatons, of all nuclear devices stockpiled in the world today. A global disaster of such magnitude, at exactly the time I suggested in Fingerprints of the Gods, does not prove the existence of a lost civilization of the Ice Age, but does at least provide us with a mechanism large enough, if such a civilization did exist, to have obliterated it almost entirely from human memory. The evidence continues to mount. Because it has such important ramifications for almost everything we think we know about the safety and security of the Earth's cosmic environment, and about our own past, it is reasonable to ask how solid the Younger Dryas comet impact theory really is. Since 2007, when it was first proposed, how has it stood up to scientific scrutiny, and what new evidence has been brought forward in support of it? The answer is that it has stood the test of time well, and benefited from a steady accumulation of new evidence set out in the proper way in the scientific literature and subject to rigorous peer review. There is neither space nor need here to explore this extensive literature in depth, but to give the general picture, I'll list the dates and titles of a few of the more important papers, with brief summaries of the conclusions and full references in the footnotes. 2008. Wildfire and abrupt ecosystem disruption on California's Northern Channel Islands at the Alerod Younger Dryas boundary. Evidence for ecosystem disruption at 13,000 to 12,900 years ago on these offshore islands is consistent with the Younger Dryas boundary cosmic impact hypothesis. 2009. Shock synthesized hexagonal diamonds in Younger Dryas boundary sediments. The presence of shock synthesized hexagonal and other nanometer-sized diamonds in YDB sediments, in association with soot and other wildfire indicators, is consistent with a cosmic impact at 12,900 years ago, and the hypothesis that the Earth crossed paths with a swarm of comets or carbonaceous chondrites, producing air shocks and/or surface impacts that contributed to abrupt ecosystem disruption and megafaunal extinctions in North America. 2010. Discovery of a nanodiamond-rich layer in the Greenland ice sheet. The presence of rounded nanodiamonds and lonsdaleite in Greenland ice suggests that a large cosmic impact occurred. The existence of this layer appears consistent with the occurrence of a major impact event that correlates with the nanodiamond-rich YDB in North America at 12,900 years ago. 2010. Paleolithic extinctions and the Taurid complex. intersection with the debris of a large 50 to 100-kilometer short-period comet during the Upper Paleolithic provides a satisfactory explanation for the catastrophe of celestial origin, which has been postulated to have occurred around 12,900 years ago, and which presaged a return to Ice Age conditions of about 1,300 years' duration. The Taurid complex appears to be the debris of this erstwhile comet. It includes about 19 of the brightest near-Earth objects. Note, the implications of this important paper by astronomer Bill Napier of the Centre for Astrobiology at the University of Cardiff, Wales, UK, will be considered in greater detail in Chapter 19. 2010. Evidence for a cosmogenic origin of fired glaciofluvial beds in the northwestern Andes, correlation with experimentally heated quartz and feldspar. Fired sediment, considered equivalent to the black mat impact of 12,000